as well as you can imagine for using a vertical on 80 meters if you went ahead and was put up just a standalone vertical. I think if I would have increased the radials, it may be would have been a really effective radiator. I think it was strictly the problem was not enough radial stick over.
I agree with you. So, Frank, you're going to have a lot of fun with this one. Which one of those gamma rods is going to work the best? Which way to hook them up? You've got a lot of variables to play with. You're going to have a lot of fun. It's not going to work perfect at first. All good ideas do not work at first. But you're going to have a tweaker's paradise. You're eventually going to find various ways to make it operate on the various bands with various bandwidth, with various tuning techniques. And so this is going to be a fun project as I see it, Frank. And keep us informed as it moves along. K2, Mike Lima, Bravo, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, thanks. I was going to ask Mel because I do have the CDs for QST and ham radio. If it was one of those, I would have been able to look it up, but I don't have communications quarterly. All right, well, thanks. I'll be listening. K2MLB.
Yeah, you have the ability to model this if you have the right computer program, and even if you don't, you find the right guy who knows how to use these modeling programs. You can model it. But when it comes to just doing an internet search, and by way of Google or whatever, shunt feeding of a tower would be a good set of words. Gamma rod feeding of a tower and whatever. You plug those various words into Google, you're going to get a pile of hits, and you start plowing through those, and you're going to find various pictures and diagrams of what guys have done, what worked and what didn't work. You can have a lot of fun with this one, and I guarantee there's a lot of data out there. I did a search, for instance, by Google on broadbanding dipole techniques. And boy, you'd be amazed how much information there is on how to broadband dipoles. Some of it's in the ARRL antenna book. One of the articles, a beautiful article on the subject, was in the December issue, 2006, of Antennas and Propagation, the IEEE, a special technical group. Beautiful technique on how to make a dipole. I mean, to make a dipole 2 or 3% broad is a pretty good trick. And this guy has a technique by which you can make the dipole 50% broad. And across that whole DON bandwidth, it gives you a reasonable visual and the exact same dipole pattern across the whole bandwidth. Beautiful technique. So, I mean, the most basic antenna that Heinrich Hertz apparently... the Hertzian dipole, way back in 1870 or whenever the hell it was. I mean, here's an antenna that's been around for 137 years. You would think we know everything we want to know about a dipole. And along comes a guy in 3 months ago, Antennas and Propagation magazine, turns it all upside down, and he's got this beautiful printed circuit technique for making a dipole super broad. So you ain't heard the end of the story yet, as you can tell, Frank. There's only 5,000 kinds of antennas in existence right now, and they're being added to at a pretty quick rate. Okay, let's go up to, I'm not sure if Bob had a question or not, but I'll give him an opportunity. KB1, OQD, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, KB1, OQD. Yeah, I had a couple of questions, Tech there. I'm new to the ham here. I just got my ticket this week here and obtained some radios here. I think it was, I don't remember, it was Alan or Russ was out there. I contacted, but apparently the only way I can get to these guys, because I'm over here in Fairfield County by the Westchester Airport there over Fairfield County, and the only way I guess I can get into your the repeater there is when the repeater is actually open and somebody had opened it. And somebody had said something, either I don't have enough power coming from my mobile, which right now I'm talking to you off in the house here off a log periodic antenna, or earlier I was in my mobile there by I-95 there, exit 3 there, in Greenwich. But one of them said it may have to be open, something to do with the PL code there. I have no way of knowing if there's a PL code here. All I have is a plus and minus. And one of the manuals I had for the radio says to go to a minus there for the frequency to get in.
Okay. You came to the right place, Bob, for about three reasons. Almost all of the repeaters on 2 meters, where you listen between 146.5
146.5 megs and 147 megs in that region, they all have a minus offset. In other words, you set up your handy talkie or your rig such that it transmits 600 kc below where you're listening. Right now you're listening to 146.85, and if you look at your dial when you're transmitting, you'll notice that it's transmitting on 146.25, 600 kc down. So the first half, the first megacycle of the 2 meter FM band, we use negative offset. Then from 147 to 147.6 or whatever, we use positive, higher frequency for the transmit versus the receive. So that's what the plus and minuses are, the offset. The PL tone means that under ordinary circumstances, not during this particular net, during ordinary circumstances, this repeater will not repeat a signal that doesn't have a tone mixed into it. And the tone is 136.5 hertz. It almost sounds like a hum if you listen to it with earphones. There's a very low frequency hum that when it's present, the repeater will let you go through. Without that hum, it will not. And the reason for those PL tones, private line tones, is to make sure that when there's a band opening and the guys are coming in from Virginia, you don't want those voices to come through our repeater up here. They use a different PL tone down there than we do up here. Well, during this particular net, the PL tone function on the repeater is turned off, so that everybody can talk to us. In other words, the guys who run this repeater said, hey, we're going to open it up to everybody during this particular couple of hours on Sunday night, so you can get in now. Almost all modern rigs, Bob, have a built-in PL tone generator. You just have to find the right paragraph in your instructions manual, in your owner's manual for that rig, to turn on that particular tone. And when you find the right way to turn it on, you're either going to find the tone that's labeled 136.5 hertz, or it's also called 4Z, 4 Zebra. And so somebody has set up a whole bunch of letter number combinations for each of the tones, because some people think the 4Z is easier to remember than 136.5. Doesn't matter. You turn on that tone, and you'll be coming through this repeater. Your rig, your location, your antenna, your log periodic, you sound beautiful. You're coming through the machine like a charm. So during the times you're not getting in, most likely that tone is not there, and that's the only reason. So good luck with all that operation. I wonder if you want to ask us anything else while you're at it. KB1, Oscar Quebec Delta, KQLIW. My name is Dick.
Well, thank you, Dick. I appreciate it. Yeah, some of the stuff that I obtained from somebody who was getting out of hand there, and as far as manuals, no. The one particular radio I'm talking to you off is the KDK 2016A. The other one was that I was talking earlier when Alan was mentioning something about it was a Kenwood TR7850, and I'm trying to obtain a manual to that, and right now with the TDK, I don't see anything on how to set the PL here. I see a tone button, but as far as anything setting it, no, I don't. I have one question that I don't want to tie everything up here because there's a lot of people out there. I have a Yaesu FT107M Heathkit lanyard and a RF components unit here, and right now I don't think I'm going to be using this equipment there, so I'm probably using it to turn around. I guess they got a swap sometime there that I'm going to get on and ask if anybody's interested or put it on eBay, because I'm probably going to stay with the 2 meter for a while, maybe when I get my general and move up there a little bit, or when I got time and be able to set up a different antenna. But anyway, Dick, I appreciate it there. Don't mind me if I can't get back call letters. I'm not quite absorbing them yet there. I'm on the local fire department here, and we don't use call letters too much there as far as that there. And it's been a while since the old TV days, remembering callers and something I got to get used to again. But anyway, I appreciate the info. Thank you very much, and everybody else out there earlier that helped me out. I hope to talk to you guys soon, as soon as I get all set up and squared away. KB1, OQD, we'll be clear, and thank you very much. 73, everybody.
W2PNJ, with a comment.
How about you?
Go ahead, Bob, W2PNJ.
Was he looking for a manual for the TR7850? I have it, if he does.
That's what he said, Bob. Is it true you were looking for a manual for a 7850 OQD? Go ahead.
Yeah, that is correct. I am looking for the manual.
I can make up photostats, and I can fax it to you if you'd like.
Fantastic. Now, what's the easiest way we can get it to you, Bob? If we look up in QRZ.com, hopefully you've been around long enough that you're already listed with an address, or what's the best way that you would like Bob, PNJ, to ship you a copy of that manual? OQD to take it?
Yeah, I'm on the database there as far as that, access it to ARRL there. Yeah, I'm listed there. I'm over here in Greenwich, Connecticut, and it's got my address there. Yeah, I definitely appreciate it there, you know. And if you can send me over that, if you need anything, you know, reimbursement for anything there, postage, anything, let me know there. But you definitely get there. If you want to copy down my phone number, I can give you my cell phone number.
WB2HW.
I can give this about W2PNJ. Let me see if I have it. I can fax it to you. If you have a fax number, I can send it right over you tonight. I got some trouble with the computer right now.
Mr. OQD, do you have a fax number?
Negative on the fax number here. No. I got an email address that's about as close as I can get, other than my physical address area, which is online.
If he was able to make it as an attachment document and send it to you email, do you think your particular server would tolerate that, OQD?
Yeah, it is possible that it might turn around and print it out there. You know, I could probably turn around and, I don't know if it was a PDF file or any kind of other file, I may be able to print it out there if it's possible.
Are you listed as KB1OQD at ARRL.net?
No, I'm not listed there as far as that on there yet, but I'm just saying if you went through my call letters, you can get my address there. But I can give you my email address.
On QRZ.com, is your email address listed there, Bob? OQD?
Negative. I haven't been able to put anything on there as far as the website there, as far as on any other listing that as far as my email address.
Why don't you tell us your email address right now?
Okay, email address is T as in Thomas, U as in Uncle, F as in Frank, E as in Edward, A as in Albert, T as in Thomas, H as in Henry, E as in Edward, R as in Robert, 211@AOL.com. That's two feather. Two feather 211. At AOL.com.
All right, this is Bob, W2PNJ. Let me have your call sign again.
It's King, Baker, 1, Oscar, Queen, David.
QSL, listen, that 7850, I have a rig here and I have it in my van. It takes those little K1 elements to change the tone on it, or you got to put one of those M3 micro miniature tone encoder boards, but it requires those K1 elements.
Roger, they may have it in because the gentleman that I obtained the radio off, he was talking about repeaters and stuff. It has a tone button on it there. Whether it's working or not, I have no idea there. And I wanted to ask Dick a question later after I clear up with you a quick too. If I was to turn around and move this other ham radio stuff there that I have, what radio would be a good radio to go as far as a mobile that I can swap in and out for a base unit too?
Yeah, that one we can't answer for you, Bob. Mel and I try not to tell people buy brand A versus brand B. That's a tough one. When it comes to a mobile rig that can be plugged in and moved to the shack, there's probably a large number of them, and which is the best one, which is the worst one. The best you can do is say, gee, somebody on eBay is selling this particular one. Does anybody know anything good or bad about it? There you'll get an answer. But when it comes to selecting all of the thousands of possible rigs, that's such a general question. The crazy example I give is, if somebody asked you, would I be happier if I marry a blonde or a brunette? You can't answer that question. There's too many variables to claim here. But if you find a Heathkit so-and-so rig or a Kenwood so-and-so rig, and you want to know is that going to be good enough for me? Do people like that particular rig? That's a good question. We can give you an answer on that one. I know Howie wanted to give us a couple of words on this one. Go ahead, Howie.
That's 2016R has a tunable PL in it. That 2016R is a nice radio. It has a tunable PL.
And he said, oh, the 2060. I thought he said KDK. And if so, that's a relatively old rig, but maybe I heard that one wrong. The 2060, run that one by again, the OQD. Did you say KDK 2060? That's what I thought I heard you say.
That's what he said, Dick, is a KDK.
Which is
old
a...
rig. It has a tunable PL inside.
Okay, so there's a way, if he had the manual on that, I think you're saying how he can get the PL on that one. Is that true?
Yeah, but what I recommend is not to use it. The thing put out a very bad square wave. Get rid of the PL deck and wire on the TS-32. I own that rig. That was a really nice radio. It had a great front end. It was tunable track tuning. That was a really nice radio, Dick.
Okay. I think you said you had another question, Bob. Why don't you hit us with the other question?
Yeah, it is a KDK. It is a 2016 there. Now, I'm not going to go playing around popping things open if I don't have to. I'd rather turn around and move the other stuff I have and upgrade to a lot easier radio that, you know, can be tuned from the outside or whatever, or manually from outside. I'm not particularly too happy about popping things open.
Understand. By the way, you're in your fire department. Are you a probie, a fairly new person, or you've been there for a long time?
I'm 2 years on there. I'm with over here in the Glenville Fire Police Unit.
Okay. Did you have another tech question for us tonight? If not, we're going to be moving on.
Negative. No. Just to see if Bob got all the information there that he needed for me for that manual.
Very good. Okay. Bob's the next man up with that. W2PNJ. Take your time, Bob, and what would you like to talk about tonight?
I was just listening to the mail, but when he mentioned 7850, my Papillon air, my ear came up, and I said, oh, I got that. I got the 7850 and the 7950. But unfortunately, it's a big deal to change the code. You got to buy those little, if they're still around, those little cylinders that you plug them in for the PL tones. There's no knobs you turn like on the nice new units.
Okay. The next person who signed in was Sid. I'm not sure if he had a question or not. K2LJH, back from up north, a former president of this club. And Sid, if you're there, go right ahead. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. It's Lou, W2BIE. We just sat down to dinner. Sid sends his regards to everybody. Everybody have a good evening. W2BIE.
Thank you, Lou. I thought he was going to be here and talk to us. I guess you talked to him, you brought him over to another band, another repeater, and had a conversation. Is that what's going on, Lou?
No, we're all sitting around the table having dinner. My wife Elaine just made dinner. We're having a late dinner since he just got here a little while ago. That's all.
Oh, in other words, Sid, is that your QTH? Oh, we didn't catch that. I thought he was in his own independent vehicle. So he's being served a good meal. Is that what's going on, Lou?
Well, let's hope so. But he'll be here a few days with us. He's going back on Thursday. He's going to say hello to all his friends. The operation was a success. He's walking like a 20-year-old, really. Okay, back to dinner. Have a good night, everybody. And Dick, keep up the good work. Back to you, Richard. W2BIE. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Lou, for all that info. Okay, the next person who signed in, let's see, was LIM with a no. Cage, I'm not sure. I think he had a no. Okay. Have I skipped anybody who gave us a yes when he signed in to the TechNet? If so, give me your call letter's name right now.
WB2HWW.
Go ahead, Howie.
I just wanted to make a comment from earlier. Remember you having a conversation about the Doppler units?
Oh, yeah. One of the things that you and I were both saying is that the way they switch the front end, the switch between all of the individual antennas, that takes art and science and care and whatever, because you can make a zillion transients that will overpower your rig something fierce. Doppler scanners, there's a lot of individual careful tweaking required to make one of them work well. Go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, speaking to the gentleman, he said they turn on and off the amplifiers
individually. And I said, that's not the way to do it. They turned the B-plus on off to a pass transistor. And we were talking about the Ramsey. They're using the 1N914 claim. Now, I don't remember, is a 1N5711 a better dial than a 1N9148 for that application, Dick?
There's no good answer to that one. Either one of those diodes with the right circuit can be made to work. And in the case of those MAR preamplifiers that he's using, the MAR is a three-terminal circuit with right network around it, where you make everything pretty fast and recovering between complete D-plus turn on and turn off. You could turn on and off the MAR amplifiers as a way of doing the switching. So there's lots of ways of doing it. But the waveform with which you do it, the coupling capacitors, the time constants, and the recovery time of your particular receiver from these front-end transients, the most sensitive portion of the receiver, the thing that goes down to a quarter of a microvolt, is the front-end. And if you're doing switching of multiple volts, turning on and off diodes, turning on and off amplifiers, you're putting volt into something that's looking for microvolts. That's 120 decibels of bang on the bell, so to speak. In other words, when you do the transient of turning on a couple of volts on the front end of a receiver, you're hitting it with a transient 120 decibels stronger than the threshold of that receiver. And the poor thing is going to really reel from that bang, and that transient you're creating when you're switching all those antennas. Stand by a second. And how quick it recovers. If your particular receiver can recover from that big a transient and do so in 10 microseconds, you're in like this. If it takes 10 milliseconds to respond from that, you're never going to get a good response out of it. So a guy can take a perfect doppel scanner system that's already installed on a car, unplug radio A and plug in radio B and expect the rest of the system to work, and it might not. So it takes an interesting marriage between the doppel scanner circuit and your particular radio, and the way you couple between the two, the way you get the video output, and so on. So doppel scanners are not simple. I mean, unless you're willing to buy somebody's complete package for $1 zillion, and I think they start off at a couple of grand, the ones that are ready to roll, completely packaged, and very few of us are willing to invest that much money into them. So we end up buying somebody's kit. And then you're going to be doing some research and talking to your buddies and finding out what modifications to do to the kit to make it work with your particular radio. So there's quite a bit of finesse required, so be a little bit careful with that. I think we haven't heard from Paul, the space, our spaceman, for quite some time. Have there been any launches lately? What are the guys doing up at the International Space Station? I've been hearing stories that there's some kind of a report took place, I guess it was, one or two issues ago in QST Magazine, where because of the way the solar panels at the International Space Station had to be positioned, that I think they took their dish antenna that was intended to speak up to the TDRS satellite, tracking data and relay satellite, the relay that gives you the communication from the International Space Station back to the ground, that antenna wasn't useful. And so they tried a standby experiment to see if the ham radio operators could put in a backup situation, supply communication. I wonder if you saw that in QST Magazine. Somebody brought that to my attention earlier today, Paul. WS2N, what's the latest in space? K2RIW in the subnet.
Okay, no, I didn't read that. I'll have to reread QST. I wonder if it was in last month. We'll have to take a closer look at that, Dick. Very good. I know they had trouble with an antenna on the Progress ship. They wanted to take a spacewalk out there about 3 or 4 weeks ago, which they did from the space station. And they went out and all they wanted to do was discard this thing. And a lot of problems with the spacesuits. One spacesuit was giving the one guy a lot of problems, and he had to really work through that. He kept overheating and all kinds of humidity problems. He wound up defogging the face mask by actually blowing on it. Big problems with their space. It happened to be one of the Russian spacesuits, by the way, all land spacesuits. not the American spaces. They have two airlocks that you can go out of on the International Space Station. The Pirate side, which is the airlock for the Russians, and then the Quest module, much bigger module where you could actually stay overnight and depressurize. Who's ever going to do the EVA? That saves time when they, the next day they can easily go out without worrying about the bends. And, they depressurize and stay, one night in the Quest lab, Quest module. But the Russian side has got some problems with their spaces. Now I'll have to read about QSD, then read that article. Dick, we're looking forward to the next mission if it ever gets up there. Due to that hailstorm that they had on the pad a few weeks ago, STS-117 Atlantis is delayed. They brought that back to their vehicle assembly building and reworking all the thousands of divots from the hail that hit the external tank part of the orbiter. I think some 28 different locations on the orbiter. Different tiles in there had to be replaced all on the port side, the left side of the orbiter. The hail was ricocheting off the assembly building and the tower itself, not the vehicle assembly building, but the tower and hitting the shuttle. So damaged part of the shuttle and damaged quite a bit of the external tank on top, all the foam. So if they can get that squared away, they should have an April launch up to the space station. They plan on putting another P3, P4 section up there. That's one of these joint trusses, which will there's a P3 and P4 up there. This is an S3 and S4, correction, a solid side. This joint rotates, and it's the one we talked about that rotates when it's operational once every hour and a half to gain the best possible angle of the sun as it goes around. As you know, it goes around once every hour and a half or every 90 minutes around the Earth. And even at that, you're not really gaining, you're only getting about an hour's worth of time. You're losing about 30 minutes. But otherwise, you're losing a lot more than that. So this increases the ability to power the station. After bumping this new truss section up to it, we'll also have attached to it the new solar panels on the starboard side, and that'll roll out 240 feet, about 40 feet wide. They'll deploy that, but only after rolling up part of the solar panel that's up there. Last time that they went up, they had problems bring back that one part of the solar P6 panel. That's the one that's been installed temporarily up there. They want to roll back the other side now. They need to have that go all the way back into its original carriage so that when this S3, S4 joint rotate, it'll be able to pass that panel without hitting it. Eventually, a future flight this year, they'll transfer that P6, completely disconnect that from its location, which sticks out of the top of the space station, where it was done, put in there temporarily, and they're going to relocate that to its proper location at the end of this whole long 11-segment truss section, this thing that's been being constructed piece at a time for years now. And once they do that, then they'll have, four independent solar panels installed, and each one has a dual set, so it's almost like eight panels, 240 feet long, 40 feet wide, roughly 20,000 kilowatts per panel. So I guess it's going to be generating around the neighborhood of 100,000 kilowatts to supply eventually six astronauts floating around in that thing there. So it's pretty interesting. Can't wait until the end of this year. Quite a bit is going to be done by the end of this year. It will almost be virtually complete. Even so, they'll be sending up other missions to fine-tune things and add a few more things here and there. By the time they close down in 2010. So that should be pretty good. And of course, the another topic, the Mars system satellites are really adding up. I was looking through it, all the different ones that we have to keep track of. You've got the Mars Express, they call it, by European Space Agency in orbit around Mars. You've got the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, that's the latest one that we put up there, going around Mars, and keeping track of the Mars Odyssey. Mars Global Surveyor, that's just failed quite a few months ago. They can't get that working back to operation. No good. And then you've got Odyssey and Spirit riding around on Mars. You've got the European Space Agency planning another one called the ExoMars mission. That's going to be a robot mission. We've got the Phoenix mission launched this August from Cape Canaveral, which will land there next year. Up in the northern plains, dig through ice. We got one right after the other. And to keep track of this, it reminds me of the early days, it used to be easy to keep track of all the spacecraft, manned and unmanned, that used to take off from Earth, and then it got quite difficult. It started to get that way now with Mars. So I'll turn it back to you, the long-winded here, K2RIWWS2M.
Fantastic. You did say 20,000 kilowatts, and then you had to set 100,000 kilowatts, which is not likely. That's a whole nuclear power station. I think you mean 20 kilowatts per panel, and 4 panels, 100 kilowatts total. And I think we've discussed in the past that comes out to be something like 165 amperes flows through that rotary joint. Did we ever settle whether or not that rotary joint has really got physical contacting brushes as opposed to an inductive coupling to an inverter? What's your best guess on that one, Paul?
N2MB, I got a question for you, Paul.
That they do have molars inside, and that's what it's done. It's done with all these rollers. No induction. Went to a couple of websites by Lockheed and one of the builders of it, Boeing, and that's what I come up with, Ben. Yeah, you're right about the kilowatts. Someday you're going to have it up there, and they're going to beam that power right back to Earth. Thank you, sir.
N2MB.
Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, Paul, I got a quickie question for you. I was reading something on the news the other day over the internet that NASA is going to have some very severe cutbacks in their robotic missions. I think they're going to cut back a lot of the missions that were planned for the moon, but also some for Mars. I wonder if you heard about that?
I read back there was something just recently on the internet about the cutbacks on some of the robotic missions, but I wouldn't get too excited. They've also cut back on the James Webb telescope. You know, that's supposed to be put on hold. Sometimes you get a different administration in there, a couple of years from now, they can reverse these things. They're looking to save the Hubble now. That was almost a dead issue. I wouldn't worry too much about it, but yeah, they do. There was something about cutting back on the some of the robotic missions. I don't know which ones they want to cut back on. A lot of them stay on the drawing board, and then they resurface, some years from now. Like the Phoenix mission that's going up this August. That was under another title there years ago. And now that's resurfaced. That one was cut right after the Mars, what was the name of that one? One that crashed into Mars, not the Mars Climate Orbiter. We lost that one. The Mars call the lander, I believe it was called, and now this is the Phoenix mission. Mars Polar lander crashed, and then we're supposed to have other ones similar to that. Well, this is a resurrection of that called the Phoenix, and it was also on the cutting board. The Dawn project, I don't know if that's going to continue, if that's going to go. Last time I read, that was on the drawing board. That's supposed to go to a couple of asteroids. So, I don't know which ones you heard. Did you hear any particular missions being cut, Barry?
Yeah, what they said was a lot of the missions to the moon were going to be cut back, and they did it in a curious way. They said that they were trying to steer the money that would have been spent on the robots towards a manned mission on the moon. I thought that was ridiculous, but that's what I saw.
Okay, Barry, I don't... Yeah, I... Something about the moon, yeah, I remember seeing that. They just plan to have some robotic missions going up there first. They're going to cut them before the manned missions. Yeah, I don't think that would be wise, but... I don't know, let's see. We'll see. Yeah, I'm trying to think. They had one planned, I think, with another couple of years. A robotic mission there. We're going to call the Martin, the Moon. Oh, what was the name of it? Moon Express or something. I forget the name of it. There was one. Maybe that was the one they're talking about. Hopefully they don't. I think they're going to need the data, Barry. Dick, over to you.
The main question I've got, Paul, what is the current status of the Hubble repair mission? I'd like to believe it's back on schedule. Have they announced an amount of time when training of the astronauts will take place and when the actual repair might take place? I hope it's on the roadmap. What do you think?
As far as about a month or so ago, it was on the roadmap. I haven't read anything recently on it, Dick. So I can't give you a current event recent story regarding that. The ham Griffin, Michael Griffin, is behind us. He wants to save the Hubble. And he's the administrator, so last I heard, a month or so ago, they were planning for it. But they have to get this thing done. I think they have some failed gyros. You know, there's problems. The advanced camera for survey, I think that's out of operation. That's that one that gives you all those beautiful pictures. They better get a move on it, Dick, before this thing fails. If it gets to the point where the gyros all fail, they can't save. They can't dock with this thing if this thing's not stable in its orbit.
That sounds to me a little bit pessimistic, yeah. And even with one gyro, I think they can get enough stability out if they can dock with it. So I don't think that's as bad a problem as it sounds. And when it comes to battery failing, solar cells failing, cameras failing, power supplies failing, computers failing, Hubble's been through that cycle multiple times before. I had some people who were working at Goddard Space Flight Center at the time giving me information as to what's really going on the inside, and that was 10 or so years ago, and boy, it sounded really terrible. The public only knew about some of the failures, but each time they keep bringing that thing back like the Phoenix, and so all you need is another Story Musgrove to go back up there again. Unfortunately, he's out of the astronaut corps. As is the lady that that tried to do that kidnapping. She's been dismissed from NASA. But still, we need another Story Musgrove dedicated individual to go back with another repair mission, because that is one hell of a piece of hardware, that thing, and they gotta get that in operation. Okay, we haven't heard for what's going on in Manhattan Beach for some time now, for a whole week. And you guys, for a whole week now, have been doing things. You gotta bring us up to date. Mel, excuse me, and you probably also have had some interesting emails. I think the last I was hearing from you, you were getting like 75 emails per week, and people asking questions, and obviously you can't handle them all. And you're going to have to tell them exactly what you can handle I'm getting 200 pieces of spam a day these days. Thank goodness I'm not getting that many emails, although I'm having trouble keeping up with all. K2KUI, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Good evening again to everybody. This is K2KUI. Yeah, as far as the email goes, yes, I've got some very interesting ones. And I could say a lot of them, I can't really help them. In fact, I'm getting mail now of people sending me these companies that are going into some kind of, hopefully to go into some kind of production, some kind of piece of equipment or whatever. And what I think of it, to invest in this company, again, I am never going to make any comments about, you know, what equipment to buy, what to invest in, or to make any kind of suggestions as to antennas, which is better, which is worse. I can't do anything like that. The interesting emails that I did get, more than one, said that the discussion we had last week on conversion from rectangular to polar and the application of polar or polar notation was very interesting. In fact, one person said it's the first time he's understood it in years that the simple explanation really worked. So basically that's the email, the extent of the email. One asked if why not, isn't there a book on straightforward simple math for use in communications, electronics, general electronics, and how many more math formulas do I have that are more or less simple, because they said the one about using the calculate frequency, capacitance, and inductance with that variable that I gave was very excellent. And they liked the one also with the quadratic method and so on and so forth. So how many more do I have? I got a whole bunch of math, basically. Why isn't this in the books? Why isn't there explanations like this step by step and so on and so forth? That's the extent of what I've gotten in emails, Dick. Most of them very positive, over.
Yes. Good time. When it comes to math, I mean, the question that I get relatively frequently when people meet me personally or occasionally if I'm not on the tech net and I'm on the air and somebody asks, what's the best antenna book I can buy? Is there a book that's going to tell me everything I need to know about antennas? Well, the subject of antennas are... It's an extremely vast subject. There's roughly 5,000 kinds of antennas. I would start off with the ARL antenna book. It's close to English and understandable that you're going to get. When it comes to an extremely thorough book, the R.C. Johnson, that's the editor, Antenna Engineering Handbook, is the one that I use almost every day. But you can't read it cover to cover. I mean, a dictionary is an extremely good book, but nobody sits down and reads the dictionary cover to cover. Oh, I've done that on a couple of occasions. You know, I'm looking up a word, and the words around it sound interesting, and I start going down the list, and I go page after page. But you don't go very far with that. You don't read the dictionary cover to cover. Well, the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the third edition, 1993, has 44 separate chapters written by 44 times two individual experts, roughly two experts per chapter, on the various classes of antennas, 44 classes of antennas of the 5,000. You don't read that book cover to cover. If you want to understand a Yagi antenna, you go to the section on Yagis. If you want to understand monopoles and dipoles, you go to chapter 4. And it starts off with a bunch of formulas. You can skip over the formulas and you go straight to the graph. Graph 4-3 and graph 4-4, extremely valuable piece of information. Somebody put a man year of effort into making those two graphs. As such, I made sure that those two graphs are on a website. If you go to WA1MBA, WA1MBA.net or .org, I'm not sure, but the Tom Williams website. And you go to the end of his website, it's a website intended for microwave ham radio operators. There's a section on Yagis, and you've got the article by K2RIW and those two graphs. And the Antenna Engineering Handbook is $150 list. Very few guys are going to buy it. Maybe you're going to buy one used from Amazon, and maybe occasionally, if you're lucky, you'll get one for $50. Go to a good-sized library, and they got it. but you read the chapter that you need. It's like the New York Times. You don't have to read it all. It's nice to know it's all there. So you read the chapter you need. A couple of people I've recommended that book to, they said, wow, that thing just overwhelmed me. It's got 1,000 pages, and I can't possibly read that. Well, you don't read it. I mean, you may not really need to know how a Warren Weber antenna works. You're not going to read that section. You're probably going to read the section on impedance matching techniques, and maybe propagation, and maybe parabolic dishes, and certainly dipoles and monopoles, and maybe Yagi antennas. Those are the most interesting sections. But that book has just been updated. The fourth edition is coming out May of 2007. I've already signed up for it. And it lists for $185. And if you buy it ahead of time from the SciTech Book Company, you can get it up until April if you order it. You get it for $139 instead of $185. And they claim that the 44 chapters became 50 chapters. They claim they revamped every single chapter. They added a hell of a lot more photographs, including color photographs, and a lot more diagrams. Well, I own every single edition of that book. The first, second, third editions I own. One of them I own two copies of it. We had a new engineer join the company that I work at the most, and I decided that he is so interested in antennas, I bought him a used copy of the third edition and handed it to him, because it was a darn good buy, and a darn worthy person that's really going to appreciate the book. That is the Bible on the subject. Another one of the Bibles is the second or third edition of Krauss's book entitled Antennas by John Krauss. And the third edition of that, very well illustrated, darn good book. Again, McGraw-Hill, expensive, and maybe you want to go to a technical library and look at it first before you decide to plunk down all the money. So start off with the antenna engineering, the ARL antenna book, and then progress to those other two, and it'll teach you something. And as I said earlier today when I was on the TechNet, was on this repeater, the subject of antennas is an extremely important subject. There are 20 kinds of wireless products we're all using. The genie is out of the bottle. We can't get enough wireless products. Every single one of those wireless products will not work without a transmitting antenna and a receiving antenna. And the saddest thing in the world is that every single college in the United States at the bachelor level barely mentions the word antenna in the electrical engineering course for the bachelor level. They get a little bit deeper into it at the master's level. So there is no formal education, per se, on the subject. You've got some books on the subject, but the books are not easy to read. So this is an extremely important subject. It's not being covered. And so I wish there was some corrective action there. I'm on my hobby horse again. I got you off the subject, Mel. K2KEY. Why don't you read one of the emails to us if you'd like? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, yeah, you're 100% right. I've got if I look at it, I think it stands a foot high. My manuals on antennas, I have those books basically that you mentioned from the older edition. Some of them a little bit ear-worn, as they said, from turning pages. Another book that I have here is excellent by Walt Maxwell, A Look at Reflections. Fairly good because he goes through, especially people that are interested in, you know, HF radio and things like we were just discussing, open wire feeders and all. He goes through quite a, just dug out the book, in fact, and he goes through like open wire versus coax lines. Very detailed. Oh boy, he's got so much detail in it, and especially also about how it behaves, the way these different cables and things behave on different HF bands. So let's see, and then he's got things for engineering and antenna systems. And what to look for, what to do, what pitfalls there are in it, and a whole conjugate thing here on matching and reflections. Oh boy, oh boy, maybe 100 pages just in discussion of SWR, better known as he recalls it, as a reflection mechanic. So That's also an extremely good book by Walt Maxwell, Dick, over.
Now, in the case of antennas, the most misunderstood factor of an antenna is standing wave ratio. You take any good piece of information on standing wave ratio, and I'm going to fill out one right now, and that is standing wave ratio really is reflection coefficient. If your antenna is a pure 50-ohm load, and you put it on the end of a piece of 50-ohm coax cable, all that valuable RF energy, like the 100 watts out of your transmitter, you pull into that cable, almost all of it comes out of the end of the cable, almost all of it will go into that 50-ohm antenna and get radiated into space, and none of it reflects. That's the good news. Well, every one of our antennas is not exactly 50 ohms. It may be 45 or 55 ohms resistive component, and it may have a little bit of reactance. It may act a little bit like a capacitor or a little bit like an inductor at the same time that it's acting like 55 ohms of resistance. As such, not all the energy goes into the antenna. A little bit of it reflects off the antenna. I mean, not too different from what happens when you look at the store window. You walk down Main Street and you look at a store window and you see a little bit of reflection from the window. Well, the light beam coming from 377 ohm space hit the glass is a little bit of a different impedance, and some of it reflects. Your antenna does the same thing. A little bit of it reflects. And the energy that reflects back down is going to come into the shack for the second time, and you measure the amount that came back versus the amount that went out, and you could call it reflection coefficient. That's what S11, a scattering parameter measured by a network analyzer, really is. Put that into a formula, call it rho, 1 plus rho over 1 minus rho, and that's standing wave ratio. So you're really measuring what percentage of the power you apply to the antenna reflects back. When you change the length of the feed line, if the feed line was lossless, changing the length of the feed line does not change the standing wave ratio one iota. You say those words on 20-meter handband on a Saturday afternoon, and a bunch of people will climb down your throat, say, you're absolutely wrong, because I had it happen. I measured with my standing wave ratio meter, I measured my antenna as 1.8 to 1, I added a quarter wavelength of cable, I remeasured it, and it's not 1.8 to 1, it's now 1.5 to 1. It changed. And so I know that there's a magic length of cable, an odd number of quarter wavelengths, an even number of half wavelengths, a full interval of a half wavelength, a full interval of a wavelength. They got all kinds of theories where they think some magic length of cable is going to make the standing wave ratio go away. There's a ridiculous number of people out there who believe that hogwash. And they make a sincere measurement with their standing wave ratio bridge, or they may even make it with a bird wattmeter, and maybe the slug is not too well calibrated. And they come up with those changes. What you're really running into is that you don't have high directivity of your particular standing wave ratio bridge. If your standing wave ratio bridge, if your bird wattmeter or whatever is working correctly, and if by some magic you can put your hands on a perfect 50 ohm dummy load, you got to make sure it's a good one. But as long as you know you got a good one and can confirm it, you apply your 100 watts forward and you set the needle full scale. You then flip to the reverse, and if you see 0 watts, you've got it made. In reality, on almost every standing wave ratio meter you can put your hands on, in the reverse mode, in that exact test with a perfect dummy load, you're going to see 5 watts, 10 watts coming back. That is the leakage of your system. It's not properly calibrated. And so now when you change the length of the cable, the real reflection signal is in phase and out of phase with that leakage signal. And by length of cable, you're changing the phase between the two, and your visual apparent will change. So everybody out there on 20 meters thinks that visual always changes with length of cable. It's because of improper instrumentation that you see that happen, and they come up with all kinds of theories to confirm it. The one other thing that happens is that now with real feed line, you got a little bit of loss in the line. So 100 watts you generate, 90 watts gets to the antenna, the antenna reflects 10 watts of it. Of the 10 watts, 9 watts gets back into the shack. If you make the visual measurement at the antenna where you apply 100 watts and see 10 watts reflected, you'll end up with a particular visual measurement. In the shack, you issue 100 watts and only 8 watts comes back because of the loss of the cable for the signal going out and the loss of the cable for the signal coming back. You'll always measure on good instrumentation better visual in the shack than at the antenna. That's simply because your feed line is an attenuator, and you're attenuating some of the signal that went out, and you're attending some of the signal that came back, and therefore you get a better reflection coefficient in the shack. A smart person will go to the right curve in the antenna handbook, the AELA antenna book, and if you know that you've got 100 feet of X cable and it's got 1 dB of loss, you go to that chart and it says whatever it is why you read, because of the 1 dB of loss of the cable, you increase it by this amount. You read a 1.5 to 1 in the shack, and maybe it's really a 1.6 to 1 because of the loss of the cable, and you're getting an optimistic reading. That couple of facts that I just told you, you'd be amazed how many people that was never told to them. The Maxwell, good old Walt Maxwell, I've talked to him a few times. He worked at RCA Estro in southern New Jersey, and on the Tyro satellite, which he worked on, they had a dipole-like antenna on the outside of the side, satellite made out of a tape measure. In other words, you got the steel tape wrapped up around the satellite. When the satellite is deployed, the squib is burned, the tape unfurls, and now you get these dipoles in space. Well, the dipole had a fairly high standing wave ratio because of the diameter of the satellite. And therefore, what Walt and his smarts did is they got a short little feed line back to the transmitter inside of the satellite. He did the impedance matching at the input end of the feed line, right at the transmitter. And various engineers are telling him, no, you can't do that. The impedance matching's got to take place right at the dipole. Well, the dipole's on the outside of the satellite, very inconvenient place to put an impedance matching. He did it on the other end of the feed line, because the feed line is so darn short, it had very little loss, it worked like a charm. A bunch of his engineers around him at RCA Estro said, it's going to fail like crazy, to which Walt said, trust me, go put it in the chamber and test it. They tested it, it worked like a charm, and they said, how the hell did you do that? He just suddenly understood what standing wave ratio really is. It's not that magic. And you can do the impedance matching in the shack if the feed line is low enough in loss. A good antenna tuner in the shack can repair a tremendous amount of errors. I have used in the past a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio inverted dipole on 20 meters on my tower. Because my impedance matching network in the shack could tolerate that, I had 90% radiation efficiency. You can't put the 20 to 1 standing wave ratio into a modern day solid state transmitter. The thing will trip itself off and say, no, I'm going to self-protect. With an antenna tuner, you can do that. If your feed line loss is low enough, standing wave ratio doesn't have to be something that traumatizes you if you understand what's going on. A 20 to 1 with a good antenna tuner is not bad. Without an antenna tuner, a 1.9 to 1 is bad because your transmitter will trip out and can't tolerate it. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, KQIIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I've gone through this and all, and I just, I don't argue with anybody anymore on the air because some of the statements are so ridiculous. I don't know where it gets started, but once it does, for some reason, it just continues. Yes, Walt Maxwell, quite a nice gentleman. 1960, I believe it was, I set up a amateur radio station at the New York Coliseum for the Boy Scouts Jamboree. They had a big to-do there at the Coliseum. And so I had the station set up to demonstrate amateur radio, run traffic and all. And Walt Maxwell stopped by and introduced himself and sat down, and he was telling me about his work at the time. I really didn't know much about it.